I'll now call the case of Beach Blitz versus City of Miami Beach, number 19-11380. I see counsel is present. Mr. Dervisi, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. Patrick Dervisi. I'm counsel for the appellant, Beach Blitz Company. Thank you very much for your time today. The issues for the court today relate to the district court's finding that the city of Miami Beach and the individual defendants, who are the mayor, the commissioners, the city attorney, and the assistant city attorney, prevailed in the trial court. The standards that the court has to review, the dispute of the parties, is whether there was a legal material alteration of this relationship between of the parties. Because that is the first standard that we have to look for. Did the defendants prevail? Once we make a determination that, assuming that the defendants prevailed, then the court cannot stop there. The analysis has to continue. And we have to look for the other prong of the test, or the second test, which is whether the claims of the plaintiffs were so vexatious and frivolous to warrant the application of the stringent test to award prevailing party defendants their attorney's fees. Obviously, the court has had the briefs reviewed and the cases that we have cited. I think that there is no dispute that the legal test as adopted by Buchanan and as amended by CRST are applicable. The only thing that this panel and your honors have to consider is whether a dismissal without prejudice under the specific facts of this case warrant a determination that this judicial imprimatur of the district court below, which is the order of dismissal without prejudice, most of the claims dismissed without.
Let me ask you a question specifically to focus this, at least for me. The district court dismissed counts 1, 2, 3, and 5 regarding the individual defendant legislators, finding that they had absolute immunity insofar as they considered and passed ordinances restricting the sale of alcohol in the MXE district. And the district court said, I'm not going to give you leave to amend. Let's hold aside the labels you paste on it, with or without prejudice. Did that not alter the legal relationships between these parties with respect to that question?
Judge, it is the appellant's position that the relationship was not materially altered in order to preclude a second lawsuit. Basically, the appellant could refile the lawsuit against the individual defendants, and I think that—
Where could you, tell me, where could you turn around and refile the exact same claim? You couldn't go back in before Judge Ungaro and do it, because she said you don't have leave to amend because it would be futile. So you couldn't go into district court and allege the same thing, could you?
We maintain that we would be able to refile, Your Honor, and the reason, and I understand—
In
that
federal court?
Yes, Your Honor, it is our position, and I understand that we are somehow engaging in a post hoc analysis and the temptations that the Florida Supreme Court has identified for all interested parties. I believe that without collaterally attacking the district court's order dismissing those claims, and as you indicated, citing that the amendment would have been futile, it is our position that the allegations were sufficient to show and reveal why the individual defendants, the liability that the appellant was looking for, did not specifically relate or exclusively relate to their legislative authority. We included—
But you see, the problem that I see is maybe the district court was right, maybe the district court was wrong insofar as she read your pleadings, but she said they had absolute immunity as legislators with regard to each and every one of the allegations you made. If she was wrong, you had the option of taking an appeal on that issue to this court, but you didn't do that.
That is correct, Your Honor. We didn't do that, and that is one of the factors that appellant took into consideration, amongst other things, and obviously we cannot disclose the client confidences, because this was one factor. The dismissal of the individual defendant's claims based on the absolute immunity was one of the factors. The other factors that had to be considered by the appellant in moving forward were that there were decisions by the district court that we said, look, maybe we can go to state court. And again, without trying to evade the question, the appellant decided to say, look, we understand that there is state remedies afforded based on the distinction that I think it was misunderstood to a certain extent between an expired business tax receipt and a lapsed business tax receipt.
Can I ask you a related question? I guess I would have thought that perhaps in response to Judge Marcus's question, you might have sort of doubled down on the decretal language or the judgment, right, wrong, or indifferent, says without prejudice, without prejudice, without prejudice. I would have thought perhaps you would have said, notwithstanding what the opinion says, the judgment of the court was without prejudice, that it was dismissed without prejudice, and that without prejudice somehow doesn't materially alter the legal relationship of the parties.
And I have to be honest, Your Honor, with that, we have raised that argument. That is the main theme of the argument is, can you have a determination on the merits under the specific facts of this case when you have a judgment that says without prejudice? That is the main theme of our brief. But I don't want to evade the question, and I want to be candid with Judge Marcus when he says, well, the District Court of Appeal, notwithstanding its prior ruling, notwithstanding the ruling on the face of the order that says without prejudice, it also went back in the order of the attorney's fees and said, well, any amendment would have been futile. So I feel that my answer answers Judge Marcus' question head on, because again, there were facts, and the truth of the matter is that we did not take an appeal of the order of the district court over dismissing the case without prejudice, and then ending up dismissing the case entirely.
Can you help me, without prejudice? Counsel, could you? I think the difficulty here is the label the district court pasted on what she was doing. Normally, when we say a case is dismissed without prejudice, it leaves you the opportunity to refile. That might be without prejudice. It might be if there was a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, the amount in controversy didn't hit the diversity requirement, for example. And you might be able to go back and plead the very same thing in a state court where you didn't have that jurisdictional requirement. But what I'm asking is, could you have gone into state court and filed exactly the same claim against these individual legislators?
Judge, I believe that even in the federal court, I think that we would have been even more clearer in our allegations. And as Judge Newsom indicated, if the order on its face says without prejudice, then I have to replead the case, and maybe as the master of my pleading, I would be more compelling to make it clear for the court that the actions that we were complaining against the individual defendants did not rely on their legislative authority, rather in their targeted actions, illegitimate conduct in trying to refuse to renew.
I guess I don't think I asked my question clearly enough. Let me try it this way. What does it mean to dismiss a case for failure to state a claim under 12b6, say it's without prejudice, and then say, I'm not giving you leave to amend. This is it as to this pleading. Ball game over. Thank you. Goodbye. How are we to read that? Is that essentially an alteration in their relationships or not? And that may turn on whether you could come back and do it again or not, doesn't it?
I don't believe that it does. It is the appellant's position, Your Honor, that we went through the state remedies process in regards to this closed permit, meaning that we could apply for a new permit, but we knew that because of the city's clear intentions on the record, they would not approve an application because it would be a non-conforming use. So the process was not there. The state remedies were not there.
But you see, wouldn't that have been a new claim? If you went back, applied for a permit, and they said no, and you had exhausted all of your remedies and you went to state court, you might well be able to plead the case again, but that would be based on something different, wouldn't it? The denial of a new application.
It would be based on that, but it still does not address the issue that the city and the individual defendants, exceeding the scope of their legislative authority, repeatedly refused to renew the license. If they were to accept my client's payment, there was no need to go through the state remedies. And that is why all these procedural due process and substantive due process were raised. And it is the appellant's position that the allegations, when taken in their totality, they addressed the court's concern. Again, it is our position that we would be able to refile the lawsuit, including the same claims. Would there be another situation where?
Well, why wouldn't repleading, let's say, in a different forum, have preclusive effect? If you had gone into, let's say, the state court and repled exactly what you pled in counts 1, 2, 3, and 5 against the individual defendants in state court, presumably the city would have said, these claims have already been adjudicated. The parties are identical. The issues are identical. And it's been adjudicated to a final resolution. Issue preclusion, it's claims preclusion, I suppose. And the district court, the state court says, you're out, res judicata under Florida's law of res judicata. Would the Florida court have been wrong to say that?
I think that the district court order of dismissal stayed a little bit away from the issue preclusion because they looked at the interest and said that there is no business, there is no fundamental right, there is no protected interest in regards to the BDR, in regards to this renewal, or in regards to the continual operation of the appellant's business. And we maintain that this was not about that, this was also about the goodwill, the asset of the businesses, the unique location of the appellant's operation. So those interests are clearly and undisputedly protected interests. So I believe that we would not have been subject to the issue or the claim preclusion, but obviously that is a hypothetical, and I think that is the best answer that I can give the court, and I can see that I overstated my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Derishi. You will have your full time remaining for rebuttal that you reserved.
Thank you.
Mr. Arana?
May it please the court, Enrique Arana on behalf of the City of Miami Beach. Your Honors, the city was the prevailing party in the action below by any measure.
Just as we're getting going, because I think as you can probably tell from the questions that Judge Marcus and I have been asking, the reason the question is so jacked up in this case is because there is this fatal mismatch between what the district court said in its opinion, these claims are dismissed for failure to state a claim and the label that she placed on it without prejudice. Those two things don't make any sense together. I mean, at least to me, it won't make any sense at all. But she doubled and tripled down on that label. Was there any effort in the district court to clear that up? Judge, the opinion suggests this should be dismissed with prejudice, but you've put without prejudice on it. You need to put with prejudice on it for this to have preclusive effect.
Your Honor, a couple things about that. First of all, there are a couple decisions which say that the label without prejudice isn't dispositive. The dependable component decision, which the trial court cited, said if it's a dismissal on the merits, it's preclusive regardless of the label you put on it. Urban versus U.S. is likewise. I think here's the point, though. The trial court, in her attorney's fees opinion, I think she explained very clearly why she put the without prejudice label on the end. And this is what she said. She said, look, the claims against the individuals are barred by legislative immunity. The procedural due process claims are barred because the plaintiffs failed to allege lack of adequate state process. And the substantive due process claim fails to state a claim because they failed to identify a fundamental right. Here's what the court said in her attorney's fees opinion. This is not a case where, for example, the dismissal was on venue grounds or for failure to establish federal question or diversity jurisdiction, such that plaintiff could immediately refile in state court or in the proper venue. This is a case where any newly filed complaint would have to allege new process to underlie its procedural due process claim. And for its substantive due process claim, any newly filed complaint would have to identify a completely new interest. If the plaintiff refiled the exact same complaint in any forum, state or federal, its claims would suffer the same deficiencies, would be barred by absolute immunity, would fail to establish due process violations, and so on. Only if the plaintiff alleges additional actions, such as pursuing and exhausting available state remedies, could it then assert a claim? And so I think what the trial court was saying is exactly what Judge Marcus was referring to.
But so you agree, right? I mean, like if the district court, either at the prompting of the parties or on her own, had put a different label on this, had rendered a with prejudice dismissal, this would be the easiest case ever, right? You would win. But because she said without prejudice, and because we have said until we're blue in the face that courts exist to render judgments, not opinions. The opinions are incidental to the judgment, and her judgment, the decretal language, is without prejudice. It complicates things here, because without prejudice almost ipso facto means no preclusive effect.
Well, what I would suggest, Your Honor, is that I think you're right. The only argument the plaintiffs have is that language without prejudice was put in the order, because it is otherwise the most straightforward case you can imagine, but it doesn't change anything. This is a ruling on the merits.
Let me ask you this, without trying to insinuate myself into your legal strategy or ask you to divulge any confidences, if you can answer the question, did you consider cross-appealing the without prejudice dismissal and asking us to render a judgment that it was in fact with prejudice?
Your Honor, I think that the answer is no, because I think the opinion is clear as to what she was saying. She the opinion makes very clear what she meant by that. She did not want to propose the possibility.
I mean, I guess basically, and I'm not casting aspersions here, you're going to ride the opinion and your opponent is going to ride the judgment. And we're going to have to decide which of those two things should control over the
other. Well, I think there's a couple other things to consider. This ruling on the merits, on a motion to dismiss, makes the city the prevailing party prior to CRST. Prior to that, where requirement, where orders are made on the merits. Now,
even if the judgment attached to it says without prejudice? I mean, yes. Is there a case pre-CRST that says, a judgment on the merits is good enough, even if the decretal language says without prejudice?
Well, we would cite the dependable component case, which says that label doesn't make a difference where it's on the merits.
Ask you a question. Aren't there two judgments here? Isn't there a judgment without prejudice? And isn't there a judgment that I'm denying you leave to amend? Isn't that also part of the decretal?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the order, it says the counts are dismissed without leave to amend. Amendment of the aforementioned counts would be futile given that plaintiff must first attempt to utilize its state remedies before seeking relief from this court.
So I just want to be clear on this point. The judgment of the district court is, I'm dismissing without prejudice. I am also barring you coming back again and amending. You can't file this claim again.
Absolutely.
Those are both decretal elements, are they not?
Absolutely. They are in the operative language.
Let me ask you then again this question, which I have struggled with, which was to understand what the district court was getting at by labeling this without prejudice. This is a very able and experienced trial judge. What was she trying to tell us? Now, I understand when you answered the question, you said, well, she said this is not like dismissing for lack of venue or lack of subject matter jurisdiction, which are plainly not merits determinations. And then she says, this really is, for all practical purposes, a merits determination. And then she paced without prejudice on the order. And I'm not understanding what the district court was trying to get at by labeling it without prejudice.
I think the best answer I can give is, again, the language of the order, of the attorney's fees order, in which she says that any newly filed complaint would have to identify a new process to underlie its due process claims. So in other words, if the plaintiffs were to follow the state court procedure, which they subsequently did, and did not receive adequate process, they potentially could file a due process claim, but it would be based upon new facts and a process that was not—
Right, but that's a different claim. That's not the claim we have here.
Correct, but I believe based on the court's opinion, that's the reason she said without prejudice.
She meant to say, you lose this round, but you can come back if you can replead and say, make a new challenge, that would be okay.
I think that's what she was getting at exactly. And that's why she says, it would be futile for you to amend now. Because
you would have to concede then that that's misapprehending the meaning of without prejudice.
I think it was in an abundance of caution, you know.
Okay.
You know,
let me ask a question in a slightly different way. I had asked your colleague the same question. Suppose your colleague turned around, walked into circuit court in Dade County and filed exactly the same claim against exactly the same parties, laying out the same factual allegata in the new case that it had offered in the district court case. And you had gone in before the state court and said, the judgment has preclusive effect. What's the answer to that? Does it have preclusive effect?
It absolutely has preclusive effect. The judge's opinion says it. If the plaintiff refiled the exact same complaint in any forum, state or federal, its claims would suffer the same deficiencies. That's in the judge's opinion,
I understand that's her opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm
asking the question, getting back to the fundamental point that Judge Newsom is raising with you, is that a state court judge picking up this order from the federal court says, yeah, but it was without prejudice.
Yeah. I think the court would look at the substance of the decision, and the decision was to dismiss the due process claim on the merits on a 12B6 motion for failure to allege inadequate state procedures.
Can I just sort of add to this conversation just something for you to think about? I mean, I'm looking in my notes at a couple of opinions, one from the Supreme Court, one from us. The Supreme Court says, dismissal without prejudice is a dismissal that does not operate as an adjudication upon the merits and thus does not have res judicata effect. That's Cooter and Gell. That's 496 U.S. 384. We've said a dismissal without prejudice is not an adjudication on the merits and thus does not have res judicata effect. That's Hughes, 350 F. 3rd at 1161. So I guess I mean, I guess we're kind of back to where we started, that you would say, well, you know, those are cases in which it was like a real dismissal without prejudice and not a confused dismissal without prejudice, where the opinion would sort of fill in the gaps in the judgment.
Correct. And I think the other thing is this, is that one of the lower court opinion goes on to say, it doesn't even, the court doesn't even have to reach the issue of whether there's preclusive effect or whether it was on the merits, because under CRST, there's a material alteration of the legal relationship between the parties. The plaintiff was rebuffed in federal court, was told they didn't state a claim, and that they would have to go follow the state procedures, which they went ahead and did. And that's very similar
to— Your argument is pure and simple. The label was the wrong label. It looks, walks, tastes, smells like a dismissal with prejudice. And therefore we have got to discard the label without prejudice to reach the substance of what the district judge was doing. That's your argument, right?
But that's point one. And point two is that even if it wasn't preclusive, we're prevailing parties under CRST because the plaintiff was rebuffed in federal court. They have to go to and follow the state procedures. But fundamentally, the first point is, yes, there is no way to look at this ruling, which dismisses on the merits, and the attorney's fees order that followed it, and see that this is anything but an adjudication on the merits. That's preclusive. She says expressly it's preclusive, and explaining why she left it without prejudice. So
isn't your point two, the CRST point, the cleaner point? I mean, I think if I were you, I would say, look, in CRST, the Supreme Court said that a defendant prevails whenever the plaintiff's challenge is rebuffed, irrespective of the precise reason for the court's decision. That's pretty broad. And then we don't have to get into all this nonsense about with prejudice, without prejudice.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's why, you know, I said that was the second point, is that we were successful. We prevailed. The plaintiff's claim was rebuffed. And it's very similar to the CRST case in which the EEOC's suit was dismissed for failure to follow pre-suit conciliation investigation requirements. And the lower court on remand there said the defendant was a prevailing party, regardless of whether there's preclusive effect, because there's a change here.
I want to ask you about frivolity in the time you have remaining.
Sure.
I'm a little concerned about the district court's ruling that the First Amendment retaliation claim was frivolous. The court found that the retaliation claim failed because each blitz failed to sufficiently allege that the protected conduct was a motivating factor in the decision to shut the business down. What's your best authority to establish that there was no arguable merit to the position that the complaint adequately alleged causation? Because the complaint says, in response to the lobbying to not change the law, the police came and shut the business down. Why isn't that sufficient? And what's the best case that says that?
Your Honor, I'd have to identify that case for you. I don't have the case at
well, see, my fingers.
But the point is that the number one, there were no facts which alleged a nexus between the speech and the closure.
There was a day's difference in timing, and the complaint said that it was a response to the lobbying effort. So I guess my point is, if there's no published case law from our circuit that says that that's not adequate, then wouldn't that mean that the district court abused its discretion in finding that the claim was frivolous?
No, absolutely not. Well, I think the first point is that as was mentioned earlier, that decision, first of all, there was no amendment. The plaintiff failed to amend the claim. He was given leave to amend to allege facts. And number two, he did not appeal that decision. And the Sidley case from this court,
the issue of frivolity is different from whether the district court erred in granting the motion to dismiss. You would agree with that, right?
What you look at on frivolity is whether they were able to establish a prima facie case. And here they could not even allege a prima facie case. And the court found that there were no facts which alleged a nexus between the protected speech and the alleged retaliation. And that was not appealed. There was no amendment to try to cure that. And this is not the opportunity.
That seems to me that goes to the prevailing party issue rather than the frivolity issue.
Your Honor, I would submit that it is the first factor in the frivolity test is whether the plaintiff can establish a prima facie case. The court found that he didn't, and that ruling was not appealed, nor did they try and amend to cure it.
But isn't the prima, excuse me, isn't the prima facie case, isn't that a summary judgment standard rather than a motion to dismiss standard? My concern is that the district court may have applied the summary judgment standard at the motion to dismiss stage by saying there weren't sufficient facts to support this allegation.
I think there has to be, you know, you have to plead ultimate facts in federal court. The court found that they hadn't, and that is the ruling that is the subject of the attorney's fees order. And
we posited, have we not, at least four factors, among others, that are relevant in determining whether or not a claim is otherwise groundless, frivolous, or unreasonable. The first ground we hold in Sullivan is whether the plaintiff has established a prima facie case. There are three others: whether the defendant offered to settle, whether the trial court dismissed the case prior to a trial in the matter, and attention is given to whether the court considered the grounds groundless in the case. Those are the kinds of things we've talked about. There were findings on each of those factors here, weren't there?
Absolutely, yes. There were findings on each of those factors, and they all weighed in favor of the city. There was no prima facie case. There was no offer to settle. The case was dismissed early on, and the law that was applied was clear. And there was no particularly complex or close question. And so there were findings on all of those issues. Those are subject to an abuse of discretion standard. The plaintiff argues in their brief that the fact that this was a dismissal on a motion to dismiss somehow cuts in their favor, but it's just the opposite. You know, oftentimes there's a question as to whether attorney's fees should be allowed on a case that's decided on summary judgment. And the courts say, well, if you weren't able to put forward enough facts to defeat a summary judgment motion, you haven't established a prima facie case. Here, the plaintiffs couldn't even allege one. They couldn't allege a prima facie claim, or they couldn't allege the elements of any cause of action. And so that element cuts in favor of the city, along with all the others. So we would ask that the court affirm with respect to entitlement for the reasons stated in our briefs, and we'll rely on our briefs for our argument that the court's reduction in the amount of over 54% of the time that the city incurred in defending the case was excessive. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, you've reserved 3 minutes.
Very briefly, Your Honor, and very quickly, I think that Judge Pryor, you hit the nail on the head on this one, because the district court did abuse the discretion when they went above and beyond the allegations that were made in the complaint. The First Amendment claim survived. There was leave to amend, but as we are seeing from our discussion today, you have opposing counsel trying to explain and support the district court's order with an explanation that came months after, in an explanation that came in the order rejecting the magistrate O'Sullivan's R&R on denying the prevailing party attorney's fees.
Can I ask you a quick question about the prevailing party issue? Can you talk to me a little bit about Mr. Arana's track two that I find sort of attractive, the CRST language that says that a defendant has fulfilled its primary objective and thus prevailed whenever the plaintiff's challenge is rebuffed, irrespective of the precise reason for the court's decision? Why isn't that exactly what happened here?
That is not exactly what happened here. I think Mr. Arana makes that point in the brief, but I think that the district court order fails on that. And again, it's that decision or that finding in the district court order that says, okay, but by the way, there is preclusive effect. But we don't even have to go through this preclusive effect because CRST says.
Yeah, see, I think I agree. I don't think we do have to go through this whole preclusive effect thing, but I think I fear that it might cut against you, because CRST says, basically, if the defendant wins the day for any reason, it's a prevailing party. And I mean, you brought a lawsuit, the defendant brought a motion to dismiss, it was granted. CRST seems to me, it says defendant wins.
And I think the question that you are posing, Judge Newsom, is a little bit cut and dry, and it doesn't take into effect the specific facts of the case, which this circuit has indicated to everybody, all litigants, has to be reviewed. So yeah, it's true that you don't have to have a judgment on the merits, that you don't have the judicial imprimatur, and in this case, you don't have to have a finding that the party prevailed on the merits.
Let me ask the question this way. If the lawsuit was dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, the amount of controversy was way less than $75,000, let's say. And therefore the district court dismissed the case. The plaintiff's claim would have been rebuffed. Would the defendant be a prevailing party under those circumstances?
Absolutely not. And in the brief, we have cited that case. The case has been in our brief says exactly that. There's two cases that we cited. One of them was for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The other case was the Orlando Communications case where they said, look, in order for you to file the claim, you have to be specific in your allegations about the pre-suit intent, meaning that the plaintiff can go right back and refile the complaint. And I think that is it's a crucial point that Judge Marcus, you make, because we could file the same action. Granted, we started another process in state court. Granted, we went through a new application, but we cannot lose fact, we cannot lose focus of the fact that the complaint was not just because we did not proceed with state remedies. The focus of the complaint was also that the city and the individual defendants repeatedly rejected the renewal of the BDR. And again, Judge Newsom, you can win on a motion to dismiss. The court gives you an order that says without prejudice, leaving the parties to scratch their heads and say, okay, what is the next action that I take? And then the district court judge comes back months later and says, but wait, by the way, I didn't give you a dismissal with prejudice. And I think the appellee's point has been that the judge didn't do that because he did not want it to somehow implicate the second process, the second state process.
Let me ask you, you're over your time, but let me just ask you in one line, whether you have anything you want to say in response to the last thing your colleague said about the amount of the award. Let's just assume that the district court properly imposed a fee here. He says the fee was cut excessively. Anything you want to say about that?
Judge, the only thing that I can do is refer to the brief, and the only fact that I can point for your honor is they asked for $290,000 for a case that was resolved in 3 months, 10 motions, 10 briefings, one evidentiary hearing. It included 7 attorneys, 5 of them shareholders. I don't think that I can say much of that. It is clearly excessive, and judge, the magistrate judge, as the R&R, as adopted by the district court judge, specifically said that the across-the-board cut was justified.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We have your case.
Thank you very much.